Welcome. My name is John Hamry. I'm glad to have you all here today. While I think we publicly argued that this was to make it convenient for Ryan Henry to get here, it's really to make my life easier. So I appreciate everybody doing that. Colonel John, why don't you get us started here? And then we'll.
Hi, my name is Colonel John Agoli. I'm the director of the Peacekeeping and Stability Operations Institute up at Carlisle, Pennsylvania. On behalf of the Chief of Staff of the Army, I'd like to welcome you to the Eisenhower National Security Seminar Series. My background as a director of PKSOI, I spent the three previous years in CENTCOM. I arrived at CENTCOM 4 weeks prior to 9/11. I had the privilege of being part of the initial planning team for Afghanistan, helping to So with that, we have seven events that are focused in the Eisenhower National Security Seminar Series on improving the USG capability to plan and execute stability ops in a more integrated fashion. We're attempting to capitalize upon the issuance of NSPD 44 by the President and the signing of DoD Directive 3000 by the Secretary of Defense. This roundtable is one of three feeder events that feed into a conference we'll be hosting on the 19th and 20th of April. And that focus of that conference is providing a forum for the discussion of what a common framework is for stability and post-conflict operations. The purpose of this event is to provide you a forum to discuss your agency's views of this mission area and to allow us to then identify where we have similarities in those views and differences in those views so that we can discuss how we can capitalize upon those differences and those common viewpoints and the difference in the viewpoints to institutionalize the development of U.S. government integrated capability to execute this mission set. What I'd like to do is bring your attention now to these slides that are in your packet talking about Event 1. I'd like to review Event 1, what the outcome of Event 1 were. In Event 1, we had a series of papers, which you can see on slide 2, which were provided by scholars to form the basis of the discussion for Event 1, which we're using the insights from that discussion to hopefully frame this discussion today, as well as the discussion for the conference in April. The key participants you can see is on slide 3.
Now,
it's developing a common strategic framework. It's a 5-slide brief. It should be in your package.
Okay, there it is.
Now, on slide 2 of the papers, and on slide 3 of the participants.
I think. Okay. This. Oh.
Does everybody have it?
Yes.
Okay. So you can see the papers that were provided, and the scholars provided the papers that framed Event 1. You can see the participants in Event 2. In Event 1, and now the key insights. And the key pieces here was that from that discussion, what we came away with is that the diverse terminology and competing frames of reference that permeate the U.S. government inhibit our development of a national understanding and capability for this mission set, that the different views of stability operations are indicative of a broader disagreement over the threats we as a government and as a nation face, that while the deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan should inform, they should not dominate the development of the strategic policy and capability required for this mission set, that there's a lack of an overarching framework for stability ops, and that inhibits thinking about the trade-offs between competing U.S. government priorities. Next slide. Again, one of the insights is the poor execution of a stability ops mission damages American prestige internationally and directly impacts on U.S. government credibility domestically. Another key finding was the role of democratization in stability ops remains highly contentious. The idea that it may sell here in the United States, but it isn't selling outside of the United States. It doesn't mean that we should not strive for that as an objective, but how do we articulate that in a way that it sells to the populace that we're trying to help, to the world that we're trying to assist? It was the idea that culturally, the U.S. is not well suited to conduct stability operations. We're a country that wants things done fast, quickly, to the point. But this is something that takes a long time to do. A long-term commitment, slow, steady progress, and a long-term commitment, as the President said often. And that's something that we seem to be culturally biased against is the viewpoint. I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that, but it's definitely something that's out there. And then finally, public diplomacy remains a highly underutilized tool. Our ability to use public diplomacy, public affairs, our ability to use information operations, and to get our view across to folks outside of the United States, to our own populace, is something that maybe we're not doing as well as we need to be doing because we're not sure how to use that tool, and we need to sort out how we're going to use that tool. Again, these are the insights from Workshop 1. Mind you, the purpose of this session is to use these insights to frame our discussion, but also to solicit from you your viewpoints on this mission set, your viewpoints of these findings, and then based on that, determine where we have commonality of purpose and where we have differing views and how we can capitalize upon that to develop a more integrated capability and approach within the United States government. I'd now like to introduce Admiral Meeks. Admiral Meeks retired after 35 years of active service as a submariner, and he culminated that service as the commander of the United States Strategic Command. He's now the head of Hicks & Associates, the CEO of Hicks & Associates. They are partnered with us for this project, and we appreciate his support. And, sir?
Thanks, John. It's
Would
a great
you
honor.
Use the microphone, please? Yeah. Just so that the center right there.
Yeah, it's a great honor for Hicks & Associates.
You have to learn how to use these things. It's a great honor for for Hicks & Associates and SAIC to co-host this with the Army. I think this is an important conference series, and I guess the only thing I was remiss about is I forgot today was St. Patrick's Day and was reminded when I got here that I didn't have any green on. The Army guys don't have to worry about that. John's, I think, concisely covered a lot of the key insights that we gained from the first workshop, and I think those are very valuable. It's clear to me that as we move forward on the whole area of stability ops and reconstruction, that we need a better framework for greater interagency integration and collaboration coordination, and part of that challenge is what this roundtable is about, to bring you together to provoke some thought on how we build that better national civil military framework that we're going to need to go forward. I think there's three central questions that we'd like you to focus on today, and that is, what is your agency's view of this mission area? What is your agency's contribution to this mission area? And what are the major obstacles and challenges that your agency will face in developing capabilities to build that civil military framework? I'm also reminded that although we're mindful of the events in Afghanistan and Iraq and how they influence our thinking about stability operations. In working with Andy Marshall and others, I think it's very important that we take a longer-term view of this whole situation, and we think about where we want to be 20 to 30 years from now, not just the near-term problems that we face. So with that, I'm really pleased that we had such a great turnout, and I'd like to take an opportunity to go around the table and ask each person to briefly introduce himself and give a quick description of the agency they're representing, because, again, there's a lot of new faces in the room, and then I'll introduce our moderator. Craig?
I'm Craig Fields. I'm a member of the Defense. Thank you. I'm Craig Fields, member of the Defense Science Board. I don't work at any agency, nor represent any. I think I was invited because I co-chaired a substantial study 2 years ago on stability and reconstruction, and then 1 year ago a follow-up to fill in some of the gaps.
I'm Ray Dubois. I'm a senior advisor here at CSIS, and spent the last 5 years working with Ryan Henry, supporting his efforts. And was instrumental in setting up Jay Garner's operation in Iraq, as well as the CPA, and spent the last year as the acting Undersecretary of the Army.
Andrew Marshall, net assessment in the Pentagon. I don't think I'm representing the DOD. Probably Ryan over there is the official representative. I mean, this is an area that interests me a lot in terms of, I think, a noticeable reluctance to really focus on it for a whole variety of reasons, and the likelihood that it's nonetheless a business we're going to be in over the longer term.
Thanks. I'm John Sagronis, Deputy Assistant Administrator at USAID. I'm in the Policy and Program Coordination Bureau, and I'm responsible for developing the agency's new policies in counterinsurgency and counterterrorism.
Good morning. Brigadier General Bo Temple here, representing the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and I was the theater engineer in Iraq from 03 to 04. Thank you.
Good morning, Barbara Stevenson, Director for Planning in the Office of the Coordinator for Reconstruction and Stabilization, an interagency office inside the State Department. The responsibility for building a better framework for interagency coordination and integration rests very squarely with us.
John Hurst with the State Department.
Jed Nadonner, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Stability Operations. And the lead Sherpa in implementing Directive 3000, as well as working for the leadership, some of the new authorities that we've worked out with the State Department on the Hill.
I'm Bruce Swartz, Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Criminal Division at the Department of Justice, responsible for international operations, including our international development and training programs, which we have in over 80 countries, thanks to the funding from our partners at State Department INL and USAID.
Brooke Darby, I'm with the Bureau for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs at the State Department. We are the office that manages U.S. contributions to civilian police operations overseas. We also run criminal justice assistance programs, training, equipment, technical assistance.
I'm Scott Norwood, and I'm here on behalf of Lieutenant General Renwart, Joint Staff J-5. I'm his deputy for a directive that was renamed yesterday, Global Strategic Partnerships. I'm Jeb's wingman for the implementation of DOD 3005.
Hank Crumpton, I'm the Ambassador for Counterterrorism, U.S. Department of State.
Mark Cornflow, I work on the Joint Staff and have worked with Admiral Jambashani, who couldn't be here today, and he's had a long-standing interest in this, both as his time as a combatant commander of Joint Forces Command and at Allied Command Transformation, and now as the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
I'm Ryan Henry from the Department of Defense. I was Craig Field's action officer on turning his study into a directive, which the secretary gave me 2 months to do, and we claimed victory about 18 months later. And the other thing is no one, Ray Dubois doesn't work for anybody with his energy level. Everybody tries to keep up with him. But I think that brings out a point. That is, we're looking at, and I'm sure there are some very smart people that put this together. I disagree with this. People can't agree on what we need to do on that. Yeah, within the Defense Department and our working with state and SCRS and stuff like that, we think everybody gets it. The problem is we've got this huge bureaucracy, and there's just and turning a bureaucracy around just takes forever. And our problem is not one of agreement and focus. Our problem is just one of getting a bureaucracy to move from worrying about 20th century problems to a 21st century set of problems and moving outside their comfort zone and things that they're just not used to doing. That's my 2 cents.
Thank you, Ron. Let me introduce the person on the other end of this little black telephone. Sam Nunn is down in Atlanta and is able to be with us for a few minutes at the outset. Senator, he's also my boss because he's the chairman of my trustees. You want to say anything, boss, or you just want to listen?
I'm just going to be in a listening mode, John. CSIS, through you, we're very delighted to be participating. I don't think there's any more important subject in this. I remember when General Shali Kashvili was retiring, I asked him, what was the number one challenge he felt that his Department of Defense faced? And he said, being able to build up the other department's capabilities and have the coordinating mechanisms between DOD and other departments of government and stability operations, that's our biggest challenge. And that, of course, was several years ago. And now we see that in very vivid terms today. So it's an important subject, and I'm going to listen in as long as I can. And I'm look forward to learning and participating in the future sessions.
Thanks a lot, boss. We'll try to keep the microphones working so you're able to hear. It's been my experience in government that all the people that don't know anything get to sit at the table, and the people that do know something sit in the back behind them. So I'd like at least to go around so that everybody that's sitting in the back introduce yourselves so we know who you are, and so we may want to jump in and ask you to.
Do you want us to cover the microphone?
No, just where you are. I think it'll be just fine.
Colonel Bill Laster, I'm the senior MA for Mr. Marshall in that assessment.
Daniel Langberg, Institute for Defense Analyses, and also working with Mr. Bob Polk in the Orange Team Project.
Bob Polk works as an adjunct at the Institute of Defense Analysis, but also directing a privately funded program, project funded by the Smith Richardson Foundation. You'll find a note in your packet about it. Thank you.
Steve Rader at SCIC and working on issues. 11 years at SCIC and many years in the Army of Iraq.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you all. And as I said, my name is John Hamry. I'm here at CSIS. There are two forms of athletic competition where you win by backing up. And one of them we do every day in Washington, and that's tug of war. And this Washington is full of people that are playing tug of war, where you got your end of the rope and you're trying to drag some other bureau or agency or department or the Congress or some or other to your over the line on your side, right? The other form of athletic competition where you win by backing up is competitive rowing, sculling. And you note you never win against another team unless you're highly coordinated. And in essence, that is the way to win in competitive rowing. Well, we are we are having to do the impossible. We have to convert a government that every day does tug of war into a government that does competitive rowing when we're under the greatest pressures. And that's the essential problem, I think, that we're wrestling with when we deal with stability operations. Now, I'd also say one of the great challenges here is a challenge of vocabulary. Everybody has a different term for this. You know, that old saying, you know, that we in the United Kingdom are two people that are separated by a common language. You know, well, we have the same problem here in government. We are a people, in this case, different departments and agencies. We all are speaking English, and we're all using the same words, but they mean very different things. So to one department, you use the word stability ops. Another department will use post-conflict reconstruction. Another department will use stabilization and reconstruction. I mean, there is a tremendous diversity. Now, it would be an easy matter if it was simply a question of collating the different, nouns and adjectives. But that isn't the issue. The issue is as underlying each of this is either explicit or implicit doctrinal understandings of what you do. Now, we in the Defense Department, and it took me as a civilian a long time to appreciate how important this is, but you guys, especially in the Army, you know, when you say movement to contact, you have a very good idea of what that means and what everybody else around you is going to be doing when you say that's your goal. Right? It's both precise and directive. But if that meant different things to different divisions, it would be chaos on a battlefield. And that is where we are, I think, so much in this very area. We do not have, it's all English, but we do not have a vocabulary that really carries with it doctrinal understanding of what we do. And it's very easy in this tug-of-war town for us to look at some other department and say, well, they don't do anything over there. You know, all they do is meet. You know? Maybe you've heard that over at my friends in the State Department. And a lot of it is the disconnect of vocabulary. Okay? So I think part of what we ought to do here at the beginning is to get an understanding. Do we really know what we're talking about in this meeting? Do we have a, and if we probably are going to share the same English words, but we don't have the common understanding of what goes underneath that. And I think we should be spending some time at the outset to describe to each other what we think this problem is. To do that, I think I'm just going to have to start picking on some people to talk about it and to get the ball rolling, because at the outset we've got to say, do we understand? We've got agency views, but a lot of the agency views tend to be in that context of tug of war, trying to get you to think about this and talk about it the way we talk about it. Okay. So, you know, Ryan, I know that you spent an enormous amount of time and in many ways moved the department to think about this, and that which ultimately led in the directive. Would you get started by saying how you think about it? And then I'm going to, frankly, John, it's probably not fair to turn to you because you not be in the right position quite yet, but you're going to get there soon. But Deborah, Barbara, you are. So I'm probably going to turn on you next, and then I'm going to start moving around the room here. Okay. Would you get us started here, Ryan?
Sure. This
administration has walked away, and specifically our department walked away from the term nation building, and it was because we think that nations build themselves, and you can't. Somebody from the outside can't come in and decide to build a nation. They have to have the political will, the desire to be able to do it. And so we have moved toward a different sort of lexicon. I guess another issue of that is, too, is we think there's critical areas where you've got to get and make the difference. You don't necessarily have to do it equally around the world. You have to align your actions and your resources where your strategic interests are. That given, though, and this is just to my personal view, is what we're interested in doing is building a civic society that can stand on its own, and can govern and can exercise accountable sovereignty. If we could get the places that we're concerned with to exercise that accountable sovereignty, then we could focus our efforts somewhere else. But many times there is a lack of governance, a misgovernance. Many of the problems that we're facing right now in the global war on terrorism, the long war, stem from misgovernment. And in the places where we had in Afghanistan, where there's ungoverned areas, it's even worse because then the adversary can move into there. So basically, we're interested in generating that accountable sovereignty. And then the steps we take about it is that, to me, my view of it is there's a Maslowian pyramid there that you get civic society at the top, but at the bottom, in the entry level, you have to provide security. And then on top of security, you can build things like essential services, the rule of law, access to political institutions, and things such as that. Where we come in at the Defense Department, though, we think that we have to provide that security foundation in order for those other things to take root. We may or may not be involved in the other aspects, and then we think that that's going to be somewhat situational. But again, I guess I understand there's friction in the system because it's a large bureaucracy, but I don't think that we have warring institutions on this problem. I think what we lacked previously was a common operational experience that we could all say there's obviously a need, we have to get involved in it, but we as a government and we as a department don't do things well the first time. And this is the first time that stability operations has been on the critical path of success. In the past, it's been a lesser included. It's been a sideshow. There have been advocates for it, but they tended to be looked at as single-issue advocates and not part of the mainstream of what we were doing in providing national security. And clearly, as we move in this global war on terrorism and being able to eliminate the causes of terrorism, because we know that we can only kill terrorists so fast, and they can generate them quicker unless we address the root causes. But addressing the root causes now, everyone agrees on, is something we have to do. We realize we don't have mechanisms how to do it. And I think that interdepartmentally, we're working pretty well in getting it. Sometimes it's within our departments, there's some issues on how much resources and how do we switch, because it's in a flat budget and resource world, it's going to be a zero-sum game. And it's always painful telling somebody what they were doing is not as important as this new thing. But working inside the government, I think we all get it, and we're willing to work together to move forward. And I think the national security strategy that came out yesterday kind of points to that, too.
Barbara?
John, thank you. I think, first of all, I'm grateful to you for framing the question the way that you did, that coordination is the essential problem, and it's a matter of shifting us from tug-of-war to competitive rowing. I think that is a great way to frame it. When we first started to address this problem about a year and a half ago in collaboration with Ryan Henry's team, I think most of us thought the problem was lack of deployable civilian capacity. What we really needed were thousands of civilians we could drop off of the C-130 boom, and then they could go about fixing water plants and power plants. And if we only had that, we'd be fine. I think we've all been on a journey together for about the last year and a half, and us with partners like the EU, the UN, the PCRU, our counterpart in the UK, recognizing that actually the problem may be more about coordinating the crew team. It may be less about tons and tons of additional resources than all pulling the rowing at the same time. And that it is a big job in its own right to actually figure out how to coordinate that crew team and get us to be a competitive rowing team instead of a tug-of-war team. We do need a common vocabulary. And I must say, John, I find it touching that you think we might be able to sort that out this morning. I think that's going to take us a lot of workshops, because there are core doctrinal issues that underlie this, and we're not trying to say, I call this a glass and you call it a cup. There is no underlying thing yet that exists, and we have to figure out what that is. The military has excellent processes for doing that. When they stood up Standing Joint Forces Headquarters, the processes that they used to sort this out are very applicable to the challenge before us. These processes, though, are alien to the civilian world, and we've had to go through even thinking about how to scope the problem. We just finished 3 weeks with Joint Forces Command doing Multinational Experiment 4, wrestling with the whole civilian-military interface. How do we integrate all this capability effectively so that we're rowing together? And we're just processing some of the results of that. But the part we found is that the things you thought might have thought would have been difficult, which is coordinating across 8 nations, reaching out to the ICRC and to Interaction, the NGO umbrella, you might have thought that would have been very difficult. Actually, what was difficult was the CivMil interface. It was easier for 8 nations to integrate militarily and 8 nations to integrate all kinds of civilian lines. But when we tried to put the civilian and military together, it was turbulence all the way to the point of failure. It's the CivMil interface that's difficult. There are ways we can address it, but common vocabulary is an absolutely essential starting point. But then beyond that, we need a common tool set. And I believe this is where Joint Forces Command is going to take the multinational experiment next, is bringing this big group of players, the 8 core nations, the EU, the UN, all of us together creating this capacity, purple from the beginning, a common tool to assess what it is that's driving the conflict so that we're all going into it with a common problem set, the kinds of things that AID will pull into their mission analysis and that the military will pull in to do a scenario. There's almost no overlap in the information set. So we need that common set, but we're well on the way of doing that with building off of AID's work. A common planning framework. That is absolutely essential for us to get unity of effort, and where that eludes us, at least transparency about what the key partners are doing and where their red lines are and where they cannot agree on the mission statement. We're kind of skipping the effort of defining what the end state is now. And so that's one of the reasons you have all of those agencies in the field just planning against their own agency goal set. And it's no wonder it looks like tug of war instead of competitive rowing. And one of the major feedbacks we're getting from the field is the amount of time the civilians are spending deconflicting as a result of that hampers their productivity by at least 50%. They would be at least twice as effective if we could come up with effective coordinating mechanisms. There's very limited civilian capacity. That's one of the real issues the processes have to overcome. Early and high, early in the planning process and high in the strategic design of figuring out what it is we're trying to achieve, maximizes limited civilian input, and it maximizes the deconfliction impact. It has to be more intuitive and streamlined. You can't just bolt civilians onto something as big and complex as DoD planning. So one of the challenges is processes that can bring us together, but I think that is a core part of the work to get us rowing together. Thanks.
Let me turn to you, John. I want you to jump in here with an AID point of view, because we're going to come back and talk a little bit about how you fit into this thing.
I'd be happy to. Already, Barbara, you've stimulated some thoughts. As you were going through the tug of war and sculling analogy, I sometimes wonder if AID's only got one oar in the water, and that's why we're rowing around in circles sometimes. I think, first of all, I've recognized in my limited time at AID that it's an organization that is basically bifurcated. There's AID Washington and there's AID in the field. And I think if we extend that to a meeting like this, that I agree with Ryan that there's an overall agreement in the federal government about what our role is. We differ, though, in mission, in the command and control structure, in the resources that we have, in the imprint we bring to bear in the field. In Washington, as we know, is a game of tug of war and politics. But in the field, I think there's a lot more coherence because the community, the country team, the civilians working with the military assets are sharing a much more common environment. So I think it works a little bit better in the field than it may appear to us in Washington. You started off by talking about language, and I couldn't agree with you more. And ironically, I think even within our own departments and agencies, we might have a difference. I certainly sense that in AID. I'll give you a couple of examples. Right before the war in Iraq, I happened to be working in the front office with the administrator at that time, Andrew Natsios, and we were discussing what in normal nomenclature in AID is the relief, recovery, reconstruction kind of continuum. And I said to Andrew, you know, it's not about reconstruction, it's about transformation. And until we understand that distinction, we are not going to be focusing on the right impact that we want to bring to bear. What is a transformation? It's a transformation on many levels, the rule of one to the rule of many, the rule of the military to the rule of to civilians, the transformation of an economy from an oil sector based economy to one that's more diversified, a command economy to a more free market economy. Understanding those kinds of transformations, then I think begins to tell the agency you've got to think about some very fundamentally different programs that you're going to have to put on the ground. How are you going to change the governance structure, not just, you know, providing computers and paper and pencils to keep it running, but how are you going to put in new laws in the books? How are you going to change the ethos of public administration? You know, we also have a debate in AID. I would say the same thing holds true in Afghanistan, predominantly any country that we're working in. In AID, there's also an assumed appreciation for the term development. Now, to me, and I happen to be a political appointee, I bring in more of a political economic development definition than some of my colleagues who are career, who look at it as a social service development program, health, education, you know, the environment. So already we see a little divergence in the road. Conflict prevention. I came on to AID because the term at the time was we're going to be involved in conflict prevention. Having gone through the 90s, we want to prevent these conflicts from occurring. And I said to again to Andrew, I think it's more a question of management and mitigation of conflict, because we're not going to be able to prevent all conflicts, and we want to achieve change. Thus, you know, the definition of development. I mean, it requires movement along a continuum from, you know, one status to another. Doing so in countries is going to change the political structure of elites, of business interests, of ethnic groups, and therefore we want to manage our interventions as best we can so we don't induce violence if we can avoid it, but we nonetheless want to proceed to affect the changes that we as a government want to affect. And I use the old straw man. What would a conflict prevention unit have looked like in the United States in 1858, and would we have wanted it to succeed? I would argue that some countries have to go through, unfortunately, violent upheavals to kind of settle the score or find the new way that they're going to be constituted. When we talk about nation building or stability ops, I think we have to bear that in mind, that there are lots of dynamics afoot in many of these countries, and to impose stability, or perhaps it's better manage and mitigate the change. You know, on the one hand, we want a peaceful world, but yet we want a world that is economically viable and politically liberal with a small L, and that's going to be disconcerting to a lot of countries. And I wonder sometimes, for example, an agency like AID, whether or not we are cognizant of the kinds of changes we are engaged with. The other thing I would talk about is leverage. I think we often overestimate the degree to which we, even in the field, let alone Washington, can affect these kinds of changes. I had an old boss who coined the phrase colonialism by ventriloquy. I think it is part of our American culture that we are not an imperial power to actually go in and run a country. I think the evidence bears that out, even in Iraq, where almost immediately there was a transition in the minds of the people in CPA to quickly get Iraqis to take ownership. You know, as one of these, the Iraqis were expecting us to take the lead, and we were saying, well, you know, we're here to kind of get the regime out of the place, but now it's, you know, your turn to govern, because we don't want to have a colonial office. And I think the Stabilization Reconstruction Office, you know, when I was working in the PCCs, that were, I don't think Clint's here, I don't see him. We were debating this, you know, are we trying to create a colonial office? You know, we're never going to call it that. Congress is never going to allow it, and that's another body I think that we have to keep in mind. So we're kind of dancing around these.
Okay. Let me jump in here to make one observation, and then I want to pivot to a couple of additional people. I'll go back to the time when I was in government. At the time, I was the comptroller, and we were working on the plan for Bosnia Herzegovina. And when remember, the negotiations were underway in Dayton, and we at DOD did a lot of detailed thinking about how we were going to structure what it was that we did. And we intentionally drew the line so that we took for ourselves jobs we knew we could do and made sure we didn't get jobs we were worried that we couldn't do. Right? And now let me just be candid. I don't say this in any dismissive or ill-hearted manner, but we knew that state wasn't up to its side of the job because you didn't know how to negotiate your line, make sure that you could do what you were being asked to do. So I think one of the key questions here when you're designing a thing like this is, do all of the Washington partners know? I think the Nigeria conference is right next door. All of the Washington partners have to be able to sit down in the planning process with equal competence to develop the plan. And I'll be candid, I don't think other agencies have that level of competence. And I think that's going to have to be a starting point. Now, John, I'm going to come right back to you and ask you, does AID and state have the capacity to sit down for in an emergency environment and design in advance the rules of engagement, the bureaucratic rules of engagement?
Certainly not design the rules of engagement. We were at a counterinsurgency conference in Fort Leavenworth a couple weeks ago, and I could almost sense the jaws hitting the table when it dawned on people that AID is an agency of 2,000 direct hires. And when you throw in the State Department's foreign service, and you know, what was the expression? You know, we can put everybody on an aircraft carrier.
That's what I go around.
Okay, it's become truth.
I kind of make that point too. Everyone just imagines that legions of foreign service officers are going to materialize in any stabilization option.
And there are many reasons for this. I mean, the evolution of AID after Vietnam and Central America. I mean, INL was an offshoot of AID, you know, in the security sector efforts that AID used to do in Vietnam. So given the constraints from Congress, Senator, you know, AID's found other ways to survive, and we've become, in effect, a general contractor. We do have people that kind of think through the strategy and how we're going to actually implement programs on the ground, but we don't have the bodies and certainly the numbers of bodies that we need to actually implement these programs. So we have to, through kind of a force multiplier role, work with NGOs or contractors in private sector, universities to multiply our reach. And there are constraints and consequences in doing that. If you give someone a grant, you don't have control by law in the way that you do if you had a contract with an organization. The skill set. If, you know, AID through the 90s wasn't really involved in hostile environments like we are today in Iraq and Afghanistan, you end up training a cadre of professionals that aren't used to that environment. So now you ask, all right, who's willing to go to Iraq and Afghanistan? And there aren't a lot of hands that go up. And then even those that do, you wonder if they have the skills, if they speak the language of the military, if they understand that, you know, this is a team effort and not a, you know, bringing the Washington Rice Bowl battles to the field. It's very complicated.
But I'd like to. You've raised a very important point. I mean, one of the reasons that DOD gets stuck, and I'll just say it with that verb, with these things, is that it is the only part of the federal government that has mobilizable capacity. You know, we just
other than DOD.
Pardon me?
DOD
is the only group that has mobilizable capacity.
Well, no, it does. I think on a much smaller scale, certainly.
Define mobilized capacity. Yeah. Can Department of State and AID direct deployment? The answer is no.
No, that's right.
No.
I mean,
the question is, should they be able to have that deployment?
Well, now you get into an issue of barrier to entry, which Jeb and I have talked about this. I don't know, Barbara, if you and I have in the past. Because it's a Washington environment that lobbies the Hill or that we put together our budgets, we were never going to lobby for lift capacity, you know, to get the AID people out there. Our OEE has been cut, for example, so we can't even hire people. There's a hiring freeze at AID. We are then dependent upon the military, for example, to
Nigeria's different regions of power rotation among parties or groups or factions has been an important element of that bargaining process. There has also been a possibility within the last 4 years for increased competition and pluralism with the emergence of new parties and the evolution of the Nigerian party system. I say the possibility, but not the realization of that potential as yet. At the same time, we see regional polarization and increased complaints from all segments of Nigerian society of marginality, marginalization. And the one compensating factor that can alleviate the tensions that are developing in Nigeria, I think, are the potential opportunities for access afforded within the political process. That is to say, when people perceive that they have access to power through elections, through party competition, through a plural civil society, we tend to see some degree of attenuation of the fierce tensions and the complaints about marginality. We see in the polling data, and I want to just put up a few quick points here, some unequivocal, strong views about term limits and the presidency and the electoral system. I could take this down so that we don't mess up the numbers and get a 1,000 somewhere because of... Okay. Let me just say something about the survey. This is our fourth round. We sampled 2,400 Nigerian citizens age 18 and above. They were randomly selected from all regions of the country. Field work was done in 31 states and Abuja. There was a 50-50 gender distribution in the sample, and we sampled language groups and urban-rural groups proportional to our best knowledge of their representation or their position in the population. So we think this was a representative, fully representative, and quite valid sample. On term limits, 84% of Nigerians believe that in Nigeria the president should obey the Constitution, including serving no more than two terms in office, while only 13% and only 4% strongly believe this. The president of Nigeria should be able to serve as many terms in office as he wishes. So the public sentiment against term limits, or rather against unlimited terms and for term limits, is unequivocal and strong. We see some regional variation in the view on term limits. In all regions, at least three-quarters of the public supports term limits, but it ranges from 90% or thereabouts in the Middle Belt, the northwest of the country, and Obasanjo's home region, where 85% of Yorubas say that they would prefer term limits and not an unlimited term, and then goes somewhat down in the northeast, Lagos, the Niger Delta, and the southeast. But in all regions, something around 80%, 8 in 10 people support term limits and are opposed to a third-term agenda. We see the strong sentiment against third terms mirrored in other views as well. 82% of Nigerians are opposed to the possibility of one-party rule. 74% are opposed to the possibility of one-man rule when we present them with these political alternatives. So again, strong, unequivocal views that all move in the same direction. We also see a tremendous deficit in confidence about the electoral process. 63% of Nigerians believe that the previous elections in 2003 either had major problems or were not free and fair at all. There's a very strong lack of confidence in elections, and only about 30% believe that the elections were relatively good. When we ask if elections enable voters to remove leaders who don't do a good job, again, 67% say no, 27% say yes. And so these are just some suggestive numbers which indicate that there is a profound lack of confidence in the electoral system. People don't feel that elections are serving the purpose of power turnover, pluralism, competition, or change in leadership. And there is a strong public sentiment, an overwhelming public sentiment, we might say, against one-party rule, strongman rule, or indefinite terms for the current president. So I think the polling numbers give us a strong empirical basis for engaging some of these questions and understanding where the public is. In conclusion, and I just wanted to make a few opening statements and then really turn this over to the rest of the panelists. In conclusion, I want to just underscore the urgency of the current situation. In the last 3-4 weeks, we've seen a new round of violence in the Niger Delta. 450,000 barrels a day of oil has been taken offline. A number of oil workers have been taken hostage. Some have been released. At least three are still held. And this suggests a new level of militancy and a new level of capabilities among militants in the Niger Delta. We've seen the so-called Danish cartoon riots in 4 cities with more than 100 people dead. And at least one of those riots in Katsina was explicitly linked to local hearings over the third-term agenda and a constitutional amendment. So the trigger for the Katsina riots we know to have been a political overlay with this question of a third term. Some people in Nigeria and elsewhere have put forward the idea that there will be continuity of reform and continuity under the current leadership, which I think is entirely illusory. I think Obasanjo would achieve a Pyrrhic victory if he achieved a third term and the PDP consolidated its control. I think there would be continued rule by the same president, but an increasingly ungovernable Nigeria. And I think we would confidently expect, unfortunately, greater polarization and possible eruptions of violence and protracted crisis of governance in the northwest, in the Niger Delta, in the eastern region, the southeast, and possibly even parts of the southwest. And so with those preliminary comments, I will turn it over to, I believe, Jibo. Yes. Welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Jibo, I hope you've been able to hear Peter's comments. Have you?
I had some of it, but his voice is very weak, which is not normal with Peter. He has a loud voice. I don't know why I'm not hearing him.
Well,
but I've read the report he circulated on the Afrobarometer, so I could follow up on that. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. It's a bit, you know, we're just cobbling this together, but I think it's going to work. So if you could go ahead and speak for 8 to 10 minutes on the issues, that would be very helpful.
Okay. I think the first point I want to make, following from Peter's presentation, is that there is a massive consensus in Nigeria against the current political developments, which have been oriented basically to prolong the rule of Obasanjo. I think it would be wrong to say there's polarization in Nigeria on that issue. What is happening is that virtually everywhere in the country, there's massive opposition to that attempt. And you have a few people around the president and some state governors leading the campaign, as it were, for the third term. It's therefore a campaign that's going on directly against the grain of popular opinion. It is also a campaign that has very strong historical resonance in Nigeria. We've been through that with Gawan. We've been through that with IBB, Badamasi Babangida, and we've been through that with Abacha. And there's a very strong bitterness in Nigeria today that President Obasanjo, who knows about that history, who has fully commented on that history and decried why previous leaders took Nigeria through that, is doing precisely the same thing out of a clear determination to intensify the level of political conflict in the country so that he can continue to rule. Let me say that the main concern in Nigeria at this time is not so much about whether Satam is correct or not, whether he's performed or not. The concern is that because it can only happen on the basis of massive use of security agencies against Nigerians and on the basis of blackmail of leading political opponents, it is bound to lead into a serious erosion of the democratic culture in the country and is therefore widely perceived as a direct threat to democracy. The other concern is that it is also a very direct attempt to undo the war against corruption, which has picked up steam over the past year. It is already apparent that there is massive bribery to get legislators and key political officials to sign in on the third term agenda. And basically, the third term agenda is the signing off on any attempt to continue the war against corruption. It is therefore, in my view, a direct threat to not just a democratic future for Nigeria, it is also a direct threat to any possibility of continuing with an attempt to establish transparency and accountability. My next point, which relates now to the political crisis in the country, and in particular to the situation in the Niger Delta area, is the way in which there is a deliberate political attempt to provoke anger in parts of the country. We recall that the various ethnic nationality leaders were arrested just before this third term thing came into the open. And it was clear that the purpose for those arrests and the reason why these people are still in detention was precisely to provoke political anger in the country. And the real question all Nigerians are posing at this point in time is what really is the political agenda of people behind this. I think there are two options the way we see it. The first option is to deliberately provoke sufficient political crisis in the country to justify a declaration of a state of emergency so that the present political leadership would continue. And those who are suggesting that this might be, the intention are doing so on the basis that all political opinion in the country is that you cannot successfully and democratically carry forward the third term agenda. The second option is not better. The second possibility is that there is a decision at the level of the presidency to completely disregard political choice in the 2007 elections and rig even more massively than they did in 2003, which means we are going to have elections that will be similar to the 1983 elections that will have absolutely no credibility and that are bound to provoke major political crisis. We feel that given these two options, there is a clear decision for the international opinion, but also for Nigerian citizens to take. At the level of Nigerian citizens, they have taken the decision to fight this third term thing so that they can save democracy and so that there will be a possibility to continue the fight against corruption. And I think it is important at this stage that international opinion comes in massively to support the Nigerian people on this particular issue. One particular question of concern as we move even closer to election date is the fact that at the level of the constitutional review for uplifting the possibilities of elections, nothing has really happened. The INEC stakeholder conference, for instance, developed very clear proposals on constitutional changes in 2003 November. They have refused to even present these proposals to the National Assembly up till this date. At the same time, the basic steps that need to be taken on elections have not been taken. For example, there's a decision that there must be voter ID card with embossed photographs. Everybody knows it will take 18 months at least to do that. We are less than 1 year from the time, and nothing has been done on that. INEC has admitted, secondly, that they do not have a voters list. Not only that it hasn't been updated since 2003, but that they've lost most of the names recorded. They have refused to resume the registration of voters, although for the past 6 months they have said they were ready to resume. The point I'm trying to make, therefore, is that we are extremely concerned that there is a deliberate strategy to take Nigeria towards political crisis. What is the purpose of such a decision is not at all clear to me, and it's not at all clear to most of the people I talk to, except that there's this determination to cling to power under whatever conditions are obtainable. And I think that this is really unfortunate for us in Nigerian civil society. I think there's a determination to fight this serious challenge to our political future and to the possibilities of a democratic future for this country. And today there was actually a major meeting by the Transition Monitoring Group and the Electoral Reform Network that reasserted this commitment of civil society to fight the third-term agenda, which at this point in our history is the same thing as saying that we must continue to fight for democracy. I think I'll stop here at this point.
Jibo, thank you very much. We are going to keep you on the line, I hope, and be able to call on you for additional comment. Are you able to do that?
Yeah, that would be fine.
Okay, good. I'd like to turn to Clement Nwankwo next as our next speaker. Clement?
Thank you, Steve. First, I'd like to express my appreciation for the opportunity of being here. I was here in July last year, and when some of these discussions came up and some of the scenarios were being put out, there was some bit of worry that it may have been an exaggerated situation. Jibo's comments and Peter's comments are, in fact, very, very apt and clearly illustrate the crisis that Nigeria is faced with. Now, there are different reasons why the crisis in Nigeria will, in fact, explode. And we already have seen some of these explosions in the terms of the different crises and protests and killings across the country. We have also seen in the last 2 months incidences of kidnapping of foreign oil workers, which I predict would not be the last, and I think will intensify in the months ahead as long as this third-term agenda is being pursued. Now, let's look at, as Jibo has indicated, the processes that the president intends to achieve his third-term agenda. And I don't think there's any doubt anymore in any mind, even if the president has not himself said that he's going to run for a third term. I don't think that there is any doubt in anybody's mind that that is clearly the agenda. And clearly he indicates, or his attitude illustrates a very blatant cleverness on his part in holding back a pronouncement on his search for a third term. Now, if you look at the constitutional process for amendment of the Constitution, it is quite clear that it requires two-thirds majority of both the Senate and the House of Representatives, and there are 469 members in both houses. You also need a majority of members in at least two-thirds of the 36 states of Nigeria's legislature to be able to pass a constitutional amendment. Now, the president has completely violated the processes leading up to a constitutional amendment, first by proposing in one whole swoop 103 constitutional amendments. All of these amendments have been pushed as one document. Discussions are not focusing on the individual components of this amendment. And people who have opposed this amendment have been arrested. Two governors specifically, one from Bayelsa State, who was arrested in London and who fled from London back to Nigeria, was clearly arrested because he was funding and supporting the opposition to the president's third term. Also in Plateau State, the governor there, who also was arrested in London, was funding and opposing the president's third term agenda. Now, they were alleged to have been corrupt. But these are not the only governors who are corrupt in Nigeria, and these are not the only public officials who are corrupt in Nigeria. In fact, the deputy chairman of the president's party, the PDP, was specifically indicted by the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, the EFCC, which the president set up. To date, he remains a very close advisor to the president and continues to speak publicly in support of the third-term agenda. So you have this problem that different instruments are being used and the president is pursuing a constitutional amendment through blackmail, through arrest, through intimidation, and, as Jibo mentioned, through bribery. There were reports in the newspapers a few days ago where two members of the National Assembly said they had been offered $1 million each and that this is the amount on the table for every member of the National Assembly who signs on to the third-term amendment, the constitutional amendment for third term. This would be about $469 million at the national level. This is a government that is fighting corruption. Where is the money coming from? And why would there be so much desperation to amend the Constitution to achieve a third term? As Peter's data indicates, and I think it's a very, very accurate, in fact, it may have even understated the opposition to the third term agenda. The president intends to pursue his third-term agenda and amendment of the Constitution. But when we look at the Constitution itself, and lots of lawyers have pointed this out, Section 137 of the Constitution is quite clear. And it says that no person who has been elected twice can seek re-election for another term. This refers to the president and to the governors. Meaning that even if the Constitution were to be amended, the president is not entitled to benefit from it. Yet the president's agenda, the president's action, the president's inclination indicates a determination to abuse the Constitution, meaning that were he to achieve an amendment of the Constitution and run for a third term, of course, he has not indicated that he is not going to go through an election. And the question is he going to seek re-election? Is he going to allow people to vote? Now, someone was telling a joke, and this is a joke that is flying through the GSM text messages, and someone said that there was a fire outbreak in Electoral Commission headquarters, and the journalists were interviewing the chairman of Electoral Commission, and he was asked the question, what is the extent of damage to the Election Commission's office? And he said, well, it's unfortunate that the entire building burnt down, but thankfully the 2007 election results are safe. And it's you might laugh, but it's the sentiment in Nigeria that there is no intention to conduct an election. And that is a very serious problem. Now, if this were to happen, then the entire legitimacy question of whatever emerges would be an issue. And like Peter mentioned, when the riots began in Nigeria between the Christians and the Muslims, it was, of course, seen by the international community as a protest against the Danish cartoon against Prophet Muhammad. But clearly, it began in Katsina State, where people started by saying that they did not want the public hearing by the National Assembly to be conducted in Katsina State. Katsina was one of the six states or six towns where the hearing was to hold. And they began to protest. And the reason they were protesting was simple. In 1998-99, there was an agreement between the North and the South that the North would rule Nigeria for the South, under President Obasanjo, who is a Southerner, would be allowed a presidency for 8 years, after which it will return to the North. Now, clearly, the beginning of these riots in the North indicated a clear statement by the North that this was a violation of that agreement. If that is the case, it means that we are bound to see a complete breakdown of law and order as this violation of this agreement continues. And now there's a historical reason for this agreement. One was the fact that Southerners in 1998 insisted that they must have the presidency for the simple reason that the North had dominated the country politically. Now, the hope was that if we were able to come up with a process that allowed for the presidency to be rotated between the North and the South, that the question of who rules the country, the struggle for political power at the presidential level, would have been eliminated and some sort of stability would have been entrenched in Nigeria. This is clearly not the case. Now you are seeing pockets of violence emerging, and my prediction is that these pockets of violence is going to escalate. You have also seen the situation in the Niger Delta with the kidnapping of foreign oil workers. Now, this is the first time this has happened in Nigeria. The last time that we had this sort of situation in Nigeria was in the last days or the last 2 years of General Sani Abacha, who died in 1998, leading up to Obasanjo's emergence, when the society had completely broken down. When this was right after Ken Saro-Wiwa was killed. Now we're seeing that kind of situation back again in the Niger Delta. And it's coming up because people are frustrated. This is a government that has not lived up to the promises that it has made. The expectations that people have that this government would deliver on its promises have not been met. And so people are frustrated. But they are even more frustrated by the fact that there doesn't seem to be the opportunity of change coming, meaning that their votes will mean nothing were they to cast it, meaning that the president continuing in office for a third term is that their own aspirations and their own expectations will continue to be dampened. And my fear is that this violence in the Niger Delta will continue. Oil supplies are currently being disrupted internationally, and I think that this will even begin to affect us locally in terms of our ability to export crude oil and will affect local income and begin to even create further crisis in terms of the economic situation in the country. Now, if Obasanjo was, again, and I'm trying to reemphasize the consequences of a third term for President Obasanjo, there would be the danger that the liberal Muslim population in the North would have failed in the eyes of the tiny radical Muslim population, and that radical Muslim population would emerge with an upper hand because they would present to the population a failure of their leaders, thereby radicalizing the Muslim population in the North. And those who stay out in the West and say that they express a fear that they don't think, or I think President Obasanjo has been making this comment, that it is important that the Muslim insurgents should be contained. My fear is that, first of all, let me state that we don't have the problem of a radical Muslim population in terms of in the political leadership in the North. But the liberal political leadership in the North would certainly face its own dangers of extinction, where it to fail to get Obasanjo to hand over power to the North in 2007. And that, I think, portends its own dangers for the rest of the country and, I think, internationally. And I think that the international community needs to be aware of these dangers, needs to be worried. The U.S. Assistant Secretary of State has made comments, and I think Ambassador Negroponte has also made comments, raising concerns about the situation in Nigeria and the dangers that this poses. My worry is that this statement perhaps needs to be said at a higher level within the U.S. government, and I think I understand that President Obasanjo may be visiting the U.S. at the end of this month, and I think it will be an important opportunity for these questions to be raised and concerns expressed about the danger that his pursuit of a third term in office posed, not just for Nigeria, because we saw what happened in Liberia. a simple confrontation and war in Liberia spilled into Ivory Coast and spilled into Guinea. I think that if you were to have that kind of confrontation in Nigeria, it would spread across the entire West African sub-region and certainly go beyond that sub-region. Thank you very much.
Clement, thank you very much. That was very compelling. We'll try to get Djibo back online. Philip Van Niekerk, could you please take the floor?
Okay. I'm going to swim slightly against the stream. And the reason is I've been going backwards and forwards to Nigeria since the 1980s. And quite frankly, the situation that Nigeria finds itself in today, it's bad, but it's probably better than at any time since the 1980s. I do not think Nigeria is about to explode. I do think that there are very significant challenges in the next 18 months up to the election. I do think it would be a great tragedy, not just for Nigeria, but for Africa, if the constitution is changed to allow the third term to continue. But I do think, and I'd like to sort of list some of the issues that I think haven't been addressed yet. I don't want to get into a discussion of the rights and wrongs of the third term and the consequences of it. But it's this administration, the Obasanjo administration, that in fact has launched an anti-corruption campaign that has gone way beyond what anybody had expected. We've had arrests of senior government officials, arrests of governors, and not in all cases can the motivation for the arrests be put down to partisanship. If you look at the lists, ministers of housing, minister of education, inspector general of police, and the governors, and the number of people that have been taken in, if you look at the operations, and be fair, of the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, I think that no one can make the case that Nuhu Ribadu is being directed by President Obasanjo to do his dirty work to undermine the deputy president. I think that the consequence, in fact, of the anti-corruption campaign that is being waged from the government at this point is a lot of what we're seeing in the issues in the Delta at this point. It would be a travesty to simply describe the governor, the former governor of Bayelsa State, and Alhaji Dokobo Asari simply as ethnic leaders. The governor of Bayelsa State was arrested by Scotland Yard for money laundering. He then, instead of facing trial in Britain, escaped as a woman back to Nigeria, where as his status as a governor would have prevented him from facing prosecution for crimes that he committed led to him being impeached and then arrested. Now, if we look at the demands that the hostage takers have made, in both cases, the number one demand is for the release of the governor of Bayelsa State. Now, this is not a simple issue. And I think this comes to the nub of what we've got to do, which is to separate the levels of criminality and the problems of law enforcement in Nigeria from the questions of the legitimate rights of the people of the South-South and of the Delta states to a better share of the incredible resources and the riches that are being taken out of their region. Now, why is the criminality issue so important? Well, for a start, we have the levels of oil bunkering. We've had estimates, we've done reports here at the CSIS which indicate that possibly up to $1 billion worth of oil is being plundered from the Delta annually. Now, that supports a massive criminal economy. And who are the participants in this, and how do you start to break that? How do you start to change that? Because you're not going to resolve the political issues in the Delta, which have to be done, until you've dealt with the criminality, because the two are increasingly being connected and tied up. And increasingly, we have armed propaganda by groups like MEND. We have an ability and a sophistication, and clearly they're very well funded, to be able to say, to make it look to the international community that they are simply rebels and that they are making, that what they are doing is fighting an unjust government. The reality in Nigeria has changed. This is no longer the time of the generals. We have a government that has moved resource share of the Delta states up to 13%, is willing to discuss that issue. That is the fundamental question which the Delta states have got to deal with at the end of the day, which is what percentage of the oil revenues is going to go back to the Delta. Now, there's been a big smokescreen around this, which is making it much harder to resolve. Part of the smokescreen is that it's precisely the governors themselves who have had the money allocated from the central government and who are pocketing it, or rather there's very little, there has been very little transparency and very little understanding of what has happened to that money. So that again becomes an issue and part of the smokescreen. Now, when you come to the law enforcement question, I think the big problem in Nigeria is we've got an inefficient and generally probably pretty corrupt police force. They cannot operate as the first responders, and they're not the ones that are operating as the first responders down in the Delta. So what do? You send in the military. Now, the army is not geared up. The army sits in the Delta almost as an army of occupation. And when they have to deal with simple law enforcement issues like going after people in the creeks, which are very difficult terrain to police anyway, they are prone to heavy-handed action and to overreaction. And we've had several instances where villages have been taken out, helicopter gunships have gone in, and that is not that the situation is not going to be resolved by the military. So again, we come back to the issue that a really thoroughgoing reform of the police, which is not going to happen overnight. I mean, in South Africa, in my country, we're still sitting, 11 years after democracy, with a police force that has deep, deep problems. They can't control hijacking in Johannesburg. And I know how difficult it is to reform the police force. And I think that is the key, and that is the number one in terms of dealing with the stability. I think in the long run, the possibility of a political settlement in the Delta is there. There are a lot of other people, other than those who are on television or are taking hostages or involved in the violence in the Delta, who represent the communities in the Delta who want to talk and who want to cut a deal with this government. I think as for the North, the difficulty there is the expectation that, as we said, that the North should, that the presidency should come back to the North in 2007. Now, that's not a particularly democratic principle either. Presumably, if the people of Nigeria are going to vote who they want, who's the best person to run the country, it doesn't necessarily have to be somebody from any particular region. And the trouble with the North is that their strength traditionally was through the military, not through the resources and not through the commercial control of the economy. And that military has been one of the reforms that Obasanjo has succeeded in doing is taking away the northern leadership from the military. The military is no longer a northern stronghold, and the military is not a threat. We are not sitting in a position where if the people of Nigeria feel a little bit despondent or feel despondent about democracy, that the military is about to take over. One of the things that Obasanjo has done is ensured that that is not on the horizon. The question then is, what is the leverage that the North can bring to bear in order to ensure that the presidency is theirs in 2007 or the next time around? And I'm not quite sure that it's very clear that they really have the power anymore in terms of, they've certainly got a lot of numbers, but in terms of their regional strength to insist. And you're seeing more and more that the demands coming from the South-South are putting the South-South kind of case onto the national agenda, so that other regions are starting to say, well, maybe we should get the presidency as well. At some point, the problem and the difficulty with that is that there is a small group of Islamist militants in the North. And as the North feels a kind of a sense of marginalization, we talk about the far North now, from the sort of general mainstream of politics in the country, that there's a tendency for that group to identify their marginalization with an Islamic or a militant, anti-Christian, anti-American, anti-Western kind of agenda. And that is something clear that one has to look at. And if we look at the recent riots over the cartoons, again, we have to see just about everything that's going to happen in Nigeria in the next 18 months in terms of this election round, in terms of the politicking that's behind it. Now, who put those people out into the streets, and what is their real agenda? You know, and I think it would be naive to simply think that it's the Nigerian people. I think a lot of people have got a lot of agendas. There's a lot of grandstanding going on, and there's a lot of opportunism, people seizing the moment to try and create difficulties at this point. I think, finally, I'd just like to, one principle in Nigerian politics is people have generally tended to underestimate Obasanjo at every step of the way. They think this is a guy, I think he's not a very good communicator, but I think that in 2003, his popularity level was at a zero. after, you know, after he raised the fuel price, after the elections, everybody said, that's it, Obasanjo's finished. This is a guy who survived as a southerner within the northern, a very northern-dominated kind of military, who's come back time and time again. He's very shrewd. The PDP, he runs the PDP at this point. And I think, that in terms of the long term, in terms of stability, that Obasanjo is not a bad horse to back, frankly.
Thank you, Philip. Darren Q.
Thank you. Well, I've been given the job to wade into the murky waters of the horse race. So with that said, here we go. The third term being, of course, the main issue that's out there. And I would say that until this last week, I would have bet that it looked fairly certain in the sense that the constitutional amendments were able to get through. There was strong support in the Senate. There was some resistance, particularly among the Northerners in the House. 73 members of the House signed a document saying no third term, which means only another 48 out of the 360 members of the House would have been needed to block constitutional amendments. There were supporters of the amendments were being offered money and guarantees of being, quote, elected in 2007. Governors are the keys to the state assemblies. As Clement said, 24 of 36 will be needed in order for the amendments to go through. Obasanjo appeared to have maybe 28 or 29 of the governors in his camp at that point, and they had been brought on board with both inducements and the fear of the EFCC treatment, which Clement and others have explained to you. After leaving office or being impeached. Mantu, the head of the Mantu Committee, promised amendments to come through within the next 3 months. But now the Mantu Committee has included a provision to take away the gubernatorial immunities in the Constitution, which throws the deal with the governors up in the air. This was initially not supposed to be part of the package of the amendments. Apparently now it's back within the package. Of course, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors around exactly what is or is not in there, but my understanding is that it is indeed part of the amendment package and that this has undermined the deal with the governors. And the new opposition party, the ACD, has been playing this up and telling the governors that they're going to be betrayed. And the EFCC has been giving hints towards this all along, so I don't think this is necessarily a deep mystery. I think the president is likely to have to drop the immunity clause in order to reverse course and to get through these amendments. But the question is how will this have damaged the sort of limited and conditional support that he has had with the governors and others within the National Assembly? I think if you add in the cartoon riots a couple of weeks ago, which his former adversary in the 2003 elections, General Buhari, attributed to anti-third term sentiments. And the BBC has also said that they're politically motivated. I think there are a lot of folks out there that are seeing those sorts of political motivations. Then you have some picture of organized resistance coming together behind those riots. Both the Christian Association of Nigeria and Arewa, the Arewa Forum, called these riots political and not religious. So you have a number of very informed folks saying that there are strong political elements to the riots that happened 2 weeks ago. President Obasanjo controls INEC, as Jibo and others have very firmly articulated for you. I only need to add that this provision of electronic voting, you might have heard, was on the table that INEC wanted to use. The Senate seems to have quashed that for the moment. The opposition was saying that this was simply going to be more centralized rigging through the electronic elections. The INEC is still talking about it. We'll see if that actually goes forward. And as Clement and others have said, there's been no real structural change within INEC, and it's been chronically underfunded would be another point that I would add. The chairman of INEC himself said that the 2003 elections were largely rigged, and he himself has also said that INEC has been chronically underfunded, and they have something about maybe 18% of their budget last year has been appropriated so far. To again underscore what Clement has said in terms of INEC being completely unprepared, Jibo also saying for the elections next year. And, of course, being thoroughly, I think, beholden to the ruling PDP at this moment. We're waiting for the census next week as well. I think this is going to be another flashpoint. In terms of the numbers game. Opposition parties are working to get organized. Most of the defectors from the PDP, which include many of the vice president's Atiku's allies, and presumed to be Atiku himself if he loses control of the PDP, are joining this new ACD. The ANPP, which controls 7 governors, the AD, which controls 1, and APGA, which now controls 1 governorship, have been having a series of merger talks. And there have been a number of announcements here and there that they're going to merge, they're going to merge. There haven't been formal announcements yet. And the EFCC is already hounding key leaders of the ACD, which certainly indicates how I think the Aso Rock is perceiving it as a threat. 7 governors are said to be more or less ready to join the ACD. I think this very much depends upon the outcome of the amendment issue. Obviously, I think if the amendments do not go through, then it's a very different ballgame. We may be in question and answer. I can fill in sort of the blanks in terms of who these governors are, or afterwards I'd be happy to kind of give you at least my impression of who some of these are. There's an 8th that has also publicly said and acknowledged his opposition to the third term. I think that's a sign of sort of which direction he may be heading. I think some of the ANPP governors may join the opposition as well. I think the Buhari faction within the ANPP is probably heading in that direction. Several of the ANPP governors are probably going to go in that direction as well, although some of the ANPP governors were also heading towards joining the PDP at one point. But now that the immunity clause is in question, there's, I think, a deep question as to which direction the governors are going to go. But I think definitely the ANPP is going to split as well as we come out of this. I think we've been talking about the North, and I think the North has been far more divided in recent years than it has been in the past, but I think they're more united now than they have been in years, primarily in opposition to President Obasanjo. And I think some of that unity is probably demonstrated in the riots we saw 2 weeks ago, as we were saying. Others have mentioned, President Obasanjo breaking the power rotation principle, which is only the last in a series of perceived slights on the part of the northern elites, and I think the northern rank and file as well. Recent acts of apparent aggression, the apparent assassination of the former governor of Kano's wife, which he himself says was targeted at him. The federal government has banned the Hizbah in Kano, which are closely connected to the governor. None of these are overtly linked to the third-term issue, of course, but they're being perceived as very much part of an ongoing strategy to disarm and to demobilize northern factions. The strategy I'm hearing out of the North at the moment really comes along 3 stages, and none of these will be very surprising, I think. First, of course, is to resist the amendment process now, particularly through the leverage of the House and through the state assemblies. And with this whole issue regarding the immunity clause, I think will definitely be an important lever for the counter-Obasanjo forces to use. We'll see how far they're able to get with that, especially once I think he probably is going to have to drop that, whether they then get back in line. Second becomes the question of who in contesting the elections in 2007. Who will they fall behind? The vice president certainly seems to be the front runner in that regard. I think that the next stage of the strategy is that if the amendments go through, then to try to put forces behind someone to unseat President Obasanjo in 2007 elections, assuming they do happen, noting very importantly Clement's caveats there. If they're thwarted again in the 2007 elections, I'm hearing some observers talking about, again, support for a coup. I think Philip very rightly notes that there are some deep structural changes that have happened in the military which make this far more difficult, in particular the different garrisons. And the military high brass is generally, and I'm on thin ice here, but I think happy with Obasanjo so far. Certainly that can change as the picture gets dicey. But what worries me, of course, is that the way the military is structured now is that, particularly if you have a junior officer coup, this increases the likelihood of a partially successful coup, which in my mind is the catastrophic scenario where you have the garrisons fighting each other, one garrison going loyalty in this direction or that direction. Again, I don't think this is the most likely scenario at this moment in time. And I think there are some significant barriers to the northern elites And again, these are not a monolithic faction by any means. They have different interests of their own, and very important interests that divide them, of course, which is not small, are they have different party factions in the North as well, which are going to play out in this calculus. But again, I think it's important to put that sort of a catastrophic scenario on the table in thinking about the North, and to say that there are certainly powers that are considering that sort of scenario as part of their strategy. I don't think that this sort of northern unity is going to hold if the third term amendment is not able to pass. I think the divisions we've seen in the last 10 years or so are going to reemerge, definitely along party lines between governors, sitting governors, and more traditional power structures and others. The Godfathers are continuing to grow more brazen. The so-called Ibadan coup in Oyo State just several months ago, where the godfather of the governor removed the governor, first of all, without the constitutionally mandated two-thirds majority in the state assembly, and the president doing nothing to stop this fact, I think shows who's holding the upper hand across the nation. In Anambra, the appeals court has gone against the governor there, Chris Ngige. So it is now held by APGA. This just happened in the last few days. I think we need to filter that through sort of who benefits from this in terms of seeing where that rolls in terms of the godfather situation. There's a growing militarization of the governors. The Ekiti governor is accused of having his own death squads. I don't think he's the only one. This is language coming from Nigerian reporters themselves that I'm using. The SSS and the military hit squads from the Abacha years are still apparently available within the military establishment. They have not been dismantled. The notorious Sergeant Rogers several months ago was reassigned to military intelligence. Just several weeks ago, he was retired. These characters are still within the military establishment. I don't know, and I'm not accusing the president or Aso Rock of necessarily utilizing these. The point is that the machinery is still there, and that there are accusations within the political elite that it is being used. I think these need to be investigated all the way back to the justice ministers. Bola Ige, his own family, accuses that the links behind that goes all the way up to the top. That murder has still not been successfully investigated. The family has taken the case out. Abubakar Rimi's accusations of a hit on him. I think these things are signs, certainly, of a very volatile political situation, but they need to be investigated. Civil society was organizing some resistance to the third term. The bar had a strike over non-respect of judicial decisions just last week, which are based on larger fears that any sort of judicial decisions that come out of the 2007 elections are not going to be respected. The Catholic bishops have said no third term, as had the Arewa Forum. The unions have been threatening some sort of resistance to the third term. We haven't seen massive action yet, but I think we can count on something coming. I'm running out of time, so let me just say, in terms of the Niger Delta, I want to underscore that that the militias and the oil bunkering networks are connected to powerful politicians within the region and outside of it as well, with some connections within the military. And most of these individuals have their own agendas as well. This deep web of connections links them into national political struggles as well as local ones. And we have many interests at play. I think in the past this has been more about mafia-style gang warfare than ethnicity. But I think this is changing. I would disagree with Philip on this point. I think we're seeing increasing self-determination issues. Of course, these meld very, very closely with financial agendas of some of these militias. But as we all know, political leaders, like all of us, have multiple agendas. So I think they're meshing very nicely. And I think we need to be careful and to pay attention to these self-determination claims in a way that we haven't in the past. Okay. In short, we're seeing a period where I think the elites are questioning whether or not it's their whether it's in their interest to play more within the system and without. And the more brazen among them are flaunting constitutional authority, like we saw in Ibadan, and among the more desperate folks in the Niger Delta. And the president himself is putting the rules up for discussion, which are seen for personal motives. And all the issues about legitimacy that others have raised, I wish to echo in this regard. I wanted to give you some future scenarios about maybe what will happen next year if the president does indeed go for a third term. Maybe we can wait until questions to discuss some of those as well. Thank you.
Thanks very much, and thanks to our audience and participants here for your patience. As you can see, I mean, it's difficult here and confusing, and just trying to get any kind of clarity on where things are moving in the big picture, and you know, what are the takeaways as to where we are right now in this and the direction events are moving, both with respect to the electoral transition and constitutional changes and the security environment. And we've got quite a bit of a debate emerging with quite contrary kind of assumptions around where this is leading and what is driving this. So I'd like to open the floor and gather some comment and discussion points and questions very briefly from, say, three or four of our participants, and then we can come back here. Princeton, do you want to lead off at all?
Thanks very much, Princeton Lyman, Council on Foreign Relations, and thanks to all the speakers. It seems to me there's another scenario out there, or a possible scenario out there that we haven't discussed, and that is that Obasanjo doesn't run for a third term, but the election is chaotic and so contested that it leads to a breakdown of law and order, and then what happens there. And that leads to the question of what American policy ought to be. Clement's comments about that and others, because where does the U.S. come down hard on a third term, and then the scenario works out to be more chaos, or being silent and then seem to be complicit in the third term, which has its other possibilities? I think the dilemma for American policy is very clear here, and I would just add one other thing. U.S. come down on one side and be ignored, and we saw that with Museveni and his determination to run for a third term. So it seems to me we've got different kinds of scenarios out there that make policy responses very complicated.
Thank you very much. Leslie? Thank you. Steve, did you want to add anything?
Sure.
Please, everybody, just give a quick snip on who you are.
One of the fascinating things that have come out, and I think I've...
Steve?
Sorry.
Just identify yourself, please.
Steve Davis.
One of the things that's come out here, I think, that's really important is... There isn't any one best bet, and that it's reasonably fluid, and some of the speakers have identified have identified groups that can have a very significant impact on the way the game is played. I do think there's a fair way to go in that, and over the next 6 months, interesting to hear Princeton say Obasanjo doesn't run. Not many people have been thinking about that, but I think that is a strong possibility. And as you say, what's the scenario then? Let me take another one. If he did run and took the third term, so what? What's the US going to do anyway? Is the US relevant in the matter? The US clearly thinks it is. But I believe that Nigerians and most of the power brokers clearly think it's not. So is it merely a matter of fascinating on the other side, all the shaking of heads, but is it a matter of this is all pretty academic from the US side anyway if Nigerian key power brokers take it into their head. What are the stakes? And some of the speakers have pointed out the stakes are very, very high, whether it's oil theft money, why do they want the power anyway? And the other last point is it's a transition. And the mistake that I think is constantly made is that we expect to see all the mechanisms in place of a full-blown, mature democracy. It's what do we get along the way? What are the reasonable steps that we can expect to see in play? And one of the things that we could do constructively is help get the steps right instead of it being a free-for-all from time to time. Thank you.
Pauline, did you want to add anything?
Well, I think one thing that we haven't yet discussed, and I'd like to hear the panelists address it, is Obasanjo's motivations for bringing, if he's not going to run, why would he bring the country to this crisis and bring friendship? It's a very dangerous kind of bring friendship, as we all know.
Say that again, Pauline.
Why would Obasanjo bring the country to this form?
Turn your mic on there.
To this form of brinkmanship. It's a very dangerous kind of brinkmanship. He's, I'm sure, very well aware of the stakes and how the country could fall apart over it. And I'm sure he's well aware of the kind of findings that Peter said, that Nigerians are rarely united on an issue, and they are very united on this issue. So is his motivation really power? Or is it a political ploy to keep his opposition off balance against Atiku? What's really going on here in his mind, other than just a power grab? And I think there must be more to it than just a power grab.
Sir, and then Joel.
Patrick Okibo, Vice President, Citigroup, founder, Vision Nigeria. I think we're better served if we move the discussion away from an academic intellectual exchange and look at more realistic scenarios. The scenario raised by Ambassador Lyman does not count because we know that for sure that Obasanjo wants to run. So let's leave that scenario out of the picture and look at the likely scenarios, which is he's going to run. And what would happen? Nothing is going to stop Obasanjo today from getting his third term because all the stars are in alignment. The congressmen are going to give him the votes. The governors are going to line up behind him once they know that they have immunity. He's using strong arm tactics against anyone who goes against him. Those who he cannot strong arm, he buys. So what's the scenarios? What are the scenarios that play out if he runs? It's everything that's been talked about today. So I just want to add that I want to emphasize the point that was made by Clement, that Nigeria is at the verge of a breakup. It is no longer an academic discussion. It's no longer an intellectual discussion. If Obasanjo runs for a third term, you can take your money to the bank that Nigeria would see severe civil strife. And it is going to be at a level that the world has never seen before because there are so many factors that are playing that are going to come into play. The civil war that was decided 30 years ago but hasn't been discussed in Nigeria for 30 years, where the hurt, people who know Nigeria know that the wounds that were opened by the civil war are still fresh and bleeding. The Niger Delta and all the minorities that played on the side of Nigeria during the war are going to fight for self-determination. So what you have is a complete implosion in Nigeria, and by extension is an implosion in the entire West African sub-region and the rest of Africa. Some of the nascent democracies in West Africa are teetering on some kind of balance because there's the big kahuna Nigeria that holds everyone to check. If Nigeria disappears from the situation, it's complete conflagration in West Africa. So as Obasanjo plans his visit to D.C. At the end of this month, I know that the number of people in this room who will be in meetings with him, some of the people in this room are handlers for Obasanjo. I hope that the questions are going to come up. I hope that we're going to raise these questions not as academic intellectual papers that are going to be written, but we see the human side of it, that lives are at stake if he takes Nigeria down the path he wants to take Nigeria. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Joel, you had some comment?
Well, it was really a very simple question following on the previous two speakers, and that is, what would it take to persuade him to stand down, and particularly what is the role of the U.S. here, and what soft landing might be viable, if any, if there are no potential soft landings, and I'm thinking at an international level, then perhaps indeed it's a done deal.
Yeah, well, that gets back to the point I think that Princeton was getting at, which has to do with certain uncertainty or limits to the whole question of influence over this decision. And we've had some pretty hard experiences in Africa and elsewhere on these kind of succession matters. And I think we have to be rather cautious in assertion that somehow the Washington's going to have some kind of decisive influence on that decision. Eric?
Eric Silla, National Television Council. I just want to follow up that question. When you answer that question, if you can identify specific leaders in Nigeria or constituencies that can help engineer that soft landing in either scenario, who are the people that need to be empowered or mobilized or engaged with by the international community to... it's clear, I think, from this discussion that the crisis, the train's already left the station, the crisis has begun. So the question is, how do we sort of avert kind of these worst-case scenarios, and who in this very sort of chaotic environment needs to be brought to the table?
Yeah. John, can you offer us any thoughts? There's been some strong assertions made around phenomena, the dynamics in the North. What do you make of – can you comment at all on that?
I was going to keep my mouth shut here tonight.
Well, you can come back in later.
I still will. Everything is in play now. There's only one issue on the table, and it's not sectarian violence, and it's not the Delta. It's the third term. And if the train is – and the train seems to be leaving the station, and I think we're all now looking at what the possibilities are there. I think it's a very dangerous and very serious situation. And I don't know what it would take to get him to stand down. And I'm not quite sure on Pauline's point of what the motivation, what the posturing, what the kabuki dance is. Is he setting someone else up? But I would have thought that a few weeks ago, maybe certainly a few months ago. Now I think just from the things that are going on at the level of him making phone calls to very serious people around the North and threatening people with threatening governors with all kinds of things, I think it has reached the point where he's put all of his put it all in terms of his bet on this option, and I don't know where it's going to go. The North, of course, has never been monolithic. As we know, there are all kinds of factions, some of them based around personalities right now. I would set aside everything we know about party labels for the moment, because that's part of what's in flux. I normally, if Obasanjo hadn't made his move, I normally would have said this is the black box period where we, on the outside, just don't know what's going on. But we'll know soon enough, and probably by April sometimes it would have been clear. The original plan was the NPP was to have their convention in April after Easter and put together some national coalitions and so forth. But I just think everything's up in the air right now, and I'm not sure where it's going to land. I don't want to get into worst-case scenarios, because I think many of us around the table have seen some pretty bad scenarios in the past, and yet Nigeria has muddled through. But the question now is, will the disillusionment be so great as to will you know, there's always been the option of centralization, federalism, and partition. Will the over-centralization option be reinforced by Abuja? Will the partition option come up, as it seems to be increasingly in south-south and southeast? And you even hear mutters in the North, but I think the North is still committed to the idea of Nigeria for all the obvious reasons. Or to get this balance right in terms of the federalism. But the National Conference didn't raise this issue. It only dealt with third term and with resource allocation, and no one is dealing with the kind of the engineering of what it would take, not in terms of personalities, because we could go on and on all day about personalities, but what it would take in terms of engineering a workable political system.
Yeah.
And I would hope people on this side of the Atlantic could put some serious thought into that question of not just chasing after the rabbits of you know, personality politics, but how do we kind of imagine the kind of, we want a democratic federal system, we want more than a single party system. The only way I see to get transparency and accountability is to have some, not only vibrant civil society, but a vibrant party system. So how does the international community create the carrots and the sticks with our limited? And I think the big thing that has changed in recent months has been the fact that the, I would say, tens of billions of windfall profits that have come into Nigeria have now flushed that system beyond anyone's capacity, anyone's normal capacity to use leverage in the sense that we're
right.
used to over here.
Right.
So basically the old you know, money side of things is just out of our hands now.
Thanks. Howard, would you like to say anything?
Not really.
No, I mean, you don't have to. You don't have to. We can...
And I agree in its fundamentals with Philip's analysis of the situation in Nigeria. Everything that we've talked about that's going wrong in Nigeria now is being linked to third term. The Niger Delta situation was there before. It has gotten worse. There are reasons why it's gotten worse. You said that in the North, the religious riots recently, the Katsina riots were linked to the third term. The riots actually started in Borno. Could they not?
Katsina.
Borno is what I heard. But how do you link that to a third term?
Right. Yeah, sorry.
The dispensation with... Alamasega and with the governor of the Ria Plateau, linked to the third term, is linked to corruption. So everyone is equating all of the wrongs in Nigeria now to a third term. It is interesting to me that Obasanjo has not spoken on this issue. And until he speaks on the issue, I frankly believe we're jumping.
Okay, thank you, Malik. Did you want to say anything? Please identify yourselves. I'm sorry, I haven't been very disciplined in asking everyone to do that for everyone's benefit. Malik.
What I see quite starkly here is the question of, on one hand, popular will, the majority of the population, if we look at the Afrobarometer, is against the third term. But we're also hearing that if President Obasanjo decides to run, he would not only run, but he would win. There seems to be a disconnect there. If the popular will says no to this, what does it say about the political dispensation if he couldn't run and win? And the issue that Philip Newkirk raised, that maybe we should bet on Obasanjo, I'd like to raise the question of what systemic option should people get behind? How can we help democratization take root in Nigeria? In continuation of the end the military rule and move it in a positive direction. On the issue of that Ambassador Jeter raised on corruption and the arrest being linked to corruption and not to the third term, then one would have to suppose that all the other governors were as clean as the driven snow, when that's clearly not the case. This is a crisis of monumental importance for not just Nigeria and not just for the sub-region, but for Africa as a whole, because Nigeria is a continental power and not just a sub-regional power.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to ask Tony Carroll to say a few words, and then I want to come back to our panel. Tony, could you identify yourself, please?
Tony Carroll with Manchester Trade, and I asked this question to some clients and colleagues from the standpoint of what they're seeing on the ground in Nigeria, and these clients and colleagues represent a bunch of interest from manufacturing to agricultural production. And I think I just want to underscore what the perception is of the average Nigerian. The unemployment is very high, increasingly so in the north. There's been a dramatic deindustrialization of Nigeria. There's been a ramping up of Chinese imports, which have further accelerated the deindustrialization process. Nigerians are heavily leveraged. Informal and formal lending is rampant at extortionary rates in many instances. The only thing that appears to be moving these days is cell phone use, which still 90% of Nigerian workers in one of these companies has a cell phone. That sucks up a lot of resources that might otherwise be used for education, health care, transportation, clothing, and what have you. So I think that the issue ought to be underscored by the notion that Nigerians in the past 5 or 7 years' lot in life is probably no better, even though oil prices have trebled in that period of time, and in fact may be worse off and acutely worse off in the north because of the phenomenon of not only mismanagement in the country, siphoning of resources to the south, but also the fact is that what little industrialization and domestic agricultural production that did exist has shrunk. So I think I'm not necessarily endorsing one or the other scenario as to how it pertains to the next term. I'm just saying that there ought to be a recognition that among Nigerians, their economic light is very much in a state of distress, and that if you bring out any sort of scenario that potentially inflames the population, they will be driven to a certain extent by their own economic dissatisfaction. So I think I'm saying neutrally on the political transition, but I'm saying that whatever happens has to understand that there's an economic plight, and particularly acutely felt in the north, that will certainly drive something of whatever happens.
And that's coming in a period in which the oil boom is delivering an avalanche of cash, and the whole the whole question of how that's deployed in this period. Why don't we come back to our participants? Clement, do you want to start off with some response? There's a number of issues, obviously, on the table. I mean, the question of what's going on. Is it possible to shape Obasanjo's decision on whether he runs or not, or drives this process? If, as many believe, it's a decision that's on its way and it's going to be taken, and the U.S. as a matter of policy is not going to stop it or shape it, then the question is, what comes afterwards? And what's the from a U.S. foreign policy standpoint, what's the strategy for dealing with the drive towards a third term, which looks like a pretty high probability right now?
Thank you. I think that there's a lot that can be done. What's going on, I don't know, and I don't think most Nigerians know, just that they're too shocked that what is going on is going on. Knowing that in 1995, President Obasanjo himself was jailed and almost killed by the military regime of General Sani Abacha, that is also played out the same kind of game that is going on today. This is my 20th year in the human rights struggle in Nigeria, and during that period I have been to jail. In the civil war that Patrick talked about, half of the members of my close family were killed. And when you look at what happened then, you saw that it was a struggle for power amongst the civilian contenders. Now, when there's a struggle for power amongst the military contenders, you can predict that one arm of that group would overthrow the one that exists and take over power. But the only experience we have of civilian struggle for power, or civilian-to-civilian struggle of power, has shown that Nigeria broke down into a civil war. And that is what frightens me. People can sit around this room and talk. One, because there are interests to be protected. But as a Nigerian who has lost family members, as a Nigerian who has been put in prison, as a Nigerian who was almost killed, as a Nigerian who has a president who today is in power but was almost killed in 1995, I am frightened for Nigeria. And I know that the danger that portends is very, very, very real. I am shocked, and I'm due apologies, Philip, that anybody would suggest in this room that Obasanjo is not a bad horse to back. Back for what? The Constitution is clear. 2 years term. After which, what you should back is continuity of democracy in Nigeria. Beyond that, the only other thing to back would be the destruction of democracy and possible resulting into a civil war. That is my fear for Nigeria. I'm not sure how much more I can say, but I think it's important that people in this room realize that Nigeria is in serious crisis. And the only people who will suffer the most would be Nigerians themselves. President Obasanjo is coming to Washington, I am told, at the end of this month. Ambassador Negroponte had made comments on the situation. The U.S. Assistant Secretary of State had made comments. But I think that President Obasanjo is someone who has played out his statesman role in the international scene. A few months ago, he had to personally go to Togo when Yasingbe Eyadema died and the constitution was violated and the person who was supposed to step in was sidestepped and a new leader put in place. Obasanjo had to go to Togo and get that situation to be reversed and the constitution respected and proper elections conducted. I think he should be reminded of those options. I think he should be reminded of his role in West Africa. Nigeria has a very important role that it has been playing and played those roles even under the brutal dictatorships of General Sani Abacha. I think it's important that when he comes here in Washington, that President Bush should be encouraged to make the point, and I think that that will really be very important to be made, that the issue of democracy in Nigeria is too important to the world. And that President Obasanjo should respect the Constitution of Nigeria and conduct a free and fair elections. Thank you.
Thank you, Clement. That's a very eloquent, powerful statement. David, I mean, Peter, would you like to follow up on some of the points? And I'll come back.
Yeah, a couple of, I guess, summary points. To me, it's neither an issue of security in Nigeria or of Obasanjo's performance. The security issues, the regional tensions, the instability is a given. It's not a question of Obasanjo's performance. We could have a discussion about whether he's done some things right, some things wrong, and so forth. Certainly in the last term, the second term, the drift in the first term has dissipated, and there have been some positive things we can point to. But that's not really the issue. The issue is democracy. The issue is there a process, a set of institutions in place that can regulate political competition, public policy, accommodation among Nigeria's regions? Is there going to be a stable political setting that can work for Nigerians? And that is the issue here. There have been other good presidents around the world. Nelson Mandela was a very popular president. He stepped down after one term for a very deliberate reason, because he didn't want to overreach. Nelson Mandela could be in power today if it was his desire, and very few people doubt that. But he chose to set another example and do things differently. I think that the upsurge and the uptick of violence and the strong and overwhelming popular sentiments that we're seeing anecdotally and in the survey data, you know, tell us how big the risks are here. And I can't remember, I want to properly attribute it, but somebody said there's an opportunity for a transition here, or we're still in a transition. I think it was Stephen who said that. And I think we're in a transition at this moment for a very different reason, because it is a third election and people expect a turnover. It's what we saw in Ukraine. It's what we saw in Kyrgyzstan. It's what we saw in Ghana in 2000. It's what we saw in Kenya. In other words, people will put up with almost anything during that first transitional election because they want the old regime to go. During the second election, they take for granted that there's a power of incumbency and that more or less two terms is the writ for any ruler. But when they anticipate a transition and they think that there's an opportunity to choose and to compete, and then suddenly, abruptly, and in non-transparent ways, that's choked off, then you see anger erupt. And then it brings things to a head. And that's what we're playing with in Nigeria today. You've got a third election, the possibility for a turnover, the possibility for choice. And people in the Delta and the East and the North and the West are all angry, and they've been angry for a long time, and they're angry for all their separate reasons, but they see an opportunity to at least get into a competitive process and vote for somebody that they prefer. And if that is snatched away from them, then in light of what Tony has said, what is left? If democracy has not performed on the economic side, if it has not brought social peace and stability, and with 200 or 300 incidents of violence and 10,000 people dead in the last 8 years, it certainly has not brought peace and stability. If it has not stemmed the endemic mass of corruption that has been Nigeria's burden for decades, then what's left? Well, what's left is that you've got these institutions, and you can vote and you can negotiate and you can appeal to the Constitution, and you've got a legal process. And if that goes away, then there are no bonds and no restraints that limit people to and constrain competition. And then you have a Hobbesian situation, and I think that you have a situation of ungovernability. And I also will just add that I don't tend to think that oil prices and material leverage is really the critical element here. I think in the past we've seen that statements from the United States can resonate broadly in Nigeria. They're reported in the press. They're brought up by everybody. And I think for Secretary of State Rice or President Bush to make a clear and unequivocal statement that President Obasanjo should retire after a job well done and become an elder statesman and respect the Constitution would resonate broadly in Nigeria and could have a very significant influence on the tide of events.
Thank you, Peter. Darren, could you respond to some of these issues that have been brought forward?
I wanted to begin, I think, with what just to echo what Peter just said, that in many ways I think the third term for me is part of a larger issue of the system in Nigeria and the increasing exit from the system we see at all levels with folks having to go their own way for a wide variety of reasons in terms of economically, with the political elites increasingly resorting to thuggery and other issues to solve their problems instead of going through the system. That's really the deepest concern, and it's also, I think, where the focus of U.S. foreign policy should be targeted. For me, I think the one sort of potentially happy point out of this whole thing is that we're seeing perhaps maybe a real opposition form in Nigeria. And the more that a serious, a viable political opposition can develop in Nigeria, I think the better this is for the system. You look at the success stories, Ghana, Kenya, Senegal, et cetera. In all of those situations, I don't know about Senegal as much, but you had opposition parties having to force serious elections and then coming into power and then beginning to give people a serious choice on the ground to actually get at some of the key economic issues that we're talking about. If Obasanjo does stick around for a third term, I think that's one possible positive that might come out of this. And I think for me, the weather vane I'm looking for is to see how whether the opposition is able to get itself together, and second, what sort of strategies do they choose? Do they decide to stay within the game if they are rigged out in 2007? And as we saw in 2003, I think, again, the largest loser in the 2003 elections was the opposition, which probably won far more seats in the National Assembly and in the governorships and so on than they actually got on the ground. Will they, after 2007, take the nonviolent resistance approach, or will they start thinking about extra-systemic solutions? That's what really worries me. But again, I think that, to echo what Peter said, those are the sorts of things that U.S. policy can put at least some strong verbal support behind in terms of calling for open political space, for calling violations on all sides of the rules of the game and trying to keep people within the game as much as possible. What if no third term? I think the president is very much playing several strategies at once. The first strategy is to get the third term. If that doesn't work, then what? I think the second strategy is to make sure, by no holds barred, to make sure that the vice president does not become president. I think that is his second priority. I think he's going to do anything and everything he can do to make sure that the vice president is not the one that succeeds him. And so, therefore, all of the political control he's gained of the PDP, the INEC, and other things, he's going to use to try to make sure that that is not who the victor is in 2007. So he's going to make sure that his preferred choice is the one that is coming up there. Although, again, the different names you see as, well, who would he possibly choose? First is General Marwa. Suddenly he's been investigated by the EFCC. The other names of sort of potential successors, as soon as their name comes up, the FCC has gone after them. So the potential successors don't seem to be very clear at the moment. But again, I think things can change very quickly. And so we need to sort of keep an eye on those sorts of things. And that really, I think, gets me to the last question about the United States in that scenario. I do agree it could be a fairly chaotic situation. If the president cannot go forward and he is actively trying to keep the vice president, who is the second most powerful politician at the moment in the country, from getting the nod, then you're going to have a deep and bruising battle within the PDP for control. And then questions of this nascent opposition, where do they fall in? Will the vice president stick with the PDP, try to use the opposition instead to try to get control? A very chaotic picture. But again, in the end, the more that it sticks within the system, this is good for democracy in the long run. If it can lead to some real viable opposition, vetting of serious political issues out there in a way that we haven't seen, and hopefully leading to some real policy platforms coming for development in the long run.
Thank you. Philip, maybe you could sort of try and bring this all together here in a rousing conclusion. I've asked Philip to think about, you know, given everything that's sort of been said here today, tie it into sort of what are the main themes we've heard and what lies ahead as far as, in your view, Philip, you know, looking out in the next period, what have to be the priority concerns and issues here?
Okay, well, obviously, the biggest concern at this point is the question of the third term, and if Obasanjo goes for it, there seems to be some little doubt left, niggling doubt left as to whether, in fact, that is what he's determined to do. What the consequences are going to be? What are the consequences in terms of the opposition? Are we going to see a massive descent into violence or civil war, as somebody has suggested? What is the outcome going to be for Nigeria? Is this Armageddon, or is it just another bump on the road? And if Obasanjo doesn't go for it, what then will be the consequences? One thing we haven't considered was mentioned by Princeton: who will be the front runner? What will be the outcome at that point? And in the context of that, the regional issues. What's going to happen in the north? What is the Islamist agenda? Is that going to emerge at all? What is going to happen in the delta? Are we seeing at this point a descent into ever greater violence? Is this really a self-determination struggle which is going to in turn lead to a civil war, or is it a greater level of criminality? And then in all of this, what is the role of the United States and where should U.S. policy be directed? And I'd like to just say something on that, because Malik pointed something very important out. If we've done the Afrobarometer survey, which says that people are so against a third term, and yet at the same time we're concluding that the train has left the station and a third term is going to happen, is it really in the United States' interest to try and stop the third term or focus its energies there, or rather on ensuring that an election, when it does happen in 2007, is as free and fair as possible. Because I think the fundamental issue in Nigeria is not really the third term. The issue is the right of ordinary Nigerians to go to the ballot and vote. If Obasanjo wants to change the constitution and allow himself to stand again, I think what the international community has to do is to ensure that the rules are in place to enable an opposition, if they want to put up a rival candidate, to defeat Obasanjo. And then on the basis of those Afrobarometer polls, we can say Obasanjo would be mighty unpopular because he's brought into play a constitutional amendment that is totally opposed by the rest of the country. So if we can ensure, build up the capacity in INEC, ensure, for instance, that governors, and that includes northern governors, delta governors, whatever, do not create private armies which are going to go around and intimidate people into voting, whatever. Ensure that the election itself is as free and fair. I think that is where the energy of the international community should be directed. Thank you.
Thank you. Peter?
Yeah, just a point about this, because Malik raised this and a couple of things have come up. Currently, the polling numbers, and it's coming from Afrobarometer, but we didn't make this stuff up. The polling numbers say that the president has a 32% approval rating, trust level somewhere around Vice President Cheney's, and strong opposition to a third term. So that's what the public thinks, and we're quite confident in the validity of those numbers. And so the question is there a contradiction here? The contradiction disappears if anybody was in Rivers State during the last two elections, or Bielsa, where the number of returns at the end of the day exceeded the number of registered voters. Where the ruling party has proven itself in two elections capable of turning a 49 or 51% majority into a 60% majority without breaking a sweat, it is not much of a reach to imagine that with the kinds of money that Clement and others are talking about being on the table, with oil revenues at an all-time high, you can skim a lot from NNPC, you can get money through otherwise, it is not much of a reach to imagine that you could take a 30% margin and turn it into a 50% or a 60% margin. And I do think that history tells us there's a threshold there. The difference between 49 and 60% is something that the public is likely to tolerate. But the difference between 30% and 60% is something that won't stand, and that just at an instinctive level, people will understand that there's been a level of theft, an inflation of something on the order of 100% in what the returns should be, and you get the scenario that you had, I believe it was in Ondo State in 1983, where the governor was elected but could not enter the state for fear of being killed by voters who felt that he shouldn't be the governor because they knew they had voted for somebody else. So I do think that the problem here is even if we were to sort of give an easy pass to the idea of a third term and say that this could be or a third term possibility and this could be an option, we have to take it as almost a given that the ruling party well-practiced in the art of rigging and electoral fraud, as well as other parties, will not fight a clean election. And we're less than a year from those elections today, or about a year from those elections today, and we do not see the machinery, the resources, the institutional development within INEC or other parts of the electoral system that would give us any confidence that we're going to see a better election in 2000. So we're looking at a double whammy, which is the perception among the public that the president has unfairly created a constitutional amendment, and then a rigged election. And I think that that is a very dangerous chemistry in the volatile politics of Nigeria.
Thank you. And I just want to, on the part of everyone, thank our speakers today. This has been very provocative and very focused, and thank you all. It's clear that, you know, that in terms of U.S. policy choice, what we're heading towards with this decision point is going to be a really hard choice as to how the White House and the administration chooses to play this next one. It's not clear to me that there's any one path that's not without high risks and high probabilities of not getting what you want. And then you have to deal with the possibility of the follow-on scenario. And it's clear also that this one's going to be a lot harder than the bumps in the road that were experienced with this latest Uganda cycle, which was not exactly a comfortable cycle and for anybody. But this one's of a different order of magnitude and complexity and danger. Thank you all for coming. We'll be back to you shortly with the next steps.